clock here. Does that matter?
Yes, I am worried about it. I didn't hear it.
I'm rolling now.
Okay. Well, we can just start with who you are, if you like, and then I'll ply you with questions.
Okay, I'm Ed Irish, and I live in Waitsfield. I was born and brought up in Warren.
Stop us for 1 second. Actually, if you want to have a seat, that would be best for us. I can hear you rattling around.
Mrs. Irish. You didn't know.
I'm sorry. And don't think too hard. No, I'm just kidding.
Okay. The microphone picks up. It's incredible, everything.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okie dokes.
Okay.
Start again? Yes, please.
I'm Ed Irish, and I live in Waitsfield. We've been here since 1948. I was born and brought up in Warren. Went to high school in Waitsfield. Went on to further education. Then spent 10 years on the west side of the state, and then a year in Connecticut and a year in Massachusetts before I came back here and bought our first farm.
Now, I wanted to start, one of the first stories I remember you telling me was, you know, growing up on your grandfather's farm and how you started out learning to milk and just how you described that whole.
Yes, I was born and brought up on the area in Warren. It was known as Grand Hollow. Presently, it's been renamed Sugar Bush. And there were six of us children, plus our father and mother, and grandfather and grandmother, Irish on my father's side. And, of course, that was a time of lanterns and lamps, not electricity. And there was always the Saturday that my mother and our grandmother either washed the lantern globes in the chimneys to the lamps and filled them with kerosene, and wash day was on Monday. Sunday was a day of rest. Nothing took place except those things that absolutely had to be done. And, of course, the means of communication were horse and buggy or horse and sleigh, sometimes various big sleds. It's all depending. We had express wagons, we had lumber wagons to carry on whatever we had to do. And as kids and the means of communication, we spent most of our time around the home. The home meant so much more back to in my estimation then than it is today. And yet we're seeing the politicians now are emphasizing the home again, which makes me feel good. We learned a lot of things at home. I know it was always interesting to help out in the fall of the year by picking the fruits. And almost every farm and farming was the major thing. Then had some orchards, had apples. We always raised a big garden. And the harvesting in the year, especially with the pumpkins, was always a thrill. And we learned a lot of other things because the home was almost self-supporting. We raised our vegetables. Potatoes was a big crop. We had, most every home had was a farm, had a few cows. We raised pigs, we had chickens, we had eggs. And so it was very important that we all learned that that was a way of getting along in life. And school was an important part about it. And among the things that I recall that I'll always remember was how we didn't have milking machines at that time. All milking was done by hand. And so it was a great thrill to learn to milk. And which I did. And the key to the whole thing was being able to hold the milk pail between your legs while you milked, Well, I just wasn't large enough to, or big enough to be able to hold the pail. And so my Uncle Fred, who was my grandfather's brother, who came over from Germany too, he made me a stool that was different from the three-legged stools that we hear so much about. It was one that I could sit on, and then there was a little platform on it that I could set the pail on so I didn't have to hold it. Well, that worked very well, but one time, I'm not sure whether the cow that I was milking was stretching to get something more out of the manger where she was eating or what, but she knocked me over, and I went onto the floor, and she stepped forward and stepped on the fleshy part of my leg, and it hurt me so that later on the imprint of her hoof was right on my leg there for quite some time. So that's probably the reason that I never forgot it. How, as I say, the home was, our home was one with a lot of love, I guess. We meant so much to each other as children. We grew up, and I think about the times that I'm going to school. It was 2.5 miles from where we live to the schoolhouse, and I know we looked forward to it a lot. But some of the time that I remember especially was when my brother and I, we were probably in fourth through the sixth or seventh grade, something like that. We walked all the time to school. And we'd get up early in the morning and leave about 7:30 and get there by 9. Get there by 9, school began at 9. But we were janitors some of the time. And we had to get there to start the fire. Well, you can imagine the cold room and starting those fires up. But that was the center of the community for the parents and for us, and so many things took place. It's hard to believe, but there was probably 10 or a dozen in general attendance over the years. And actually, some of them were not as well off as some of the rest of us, and they came to school barefooted. So you can imagine how things would change between now, as far as getting to school and back, and the transportation that we offer today.
One of the things I wanted you to tell was the story of your grandfather coming here, and how he and then Fred came over 5 years later, and how they met.
Yes, my grandfather came over from Germany in the middle 1880s, as I recall. He came into New York, and it was at that time that they, I'm not sure whether you'd say farmed out foreigners that came to this country or not, but there were applications made by people within various communities that needed help or needed someone. And he came into New York and then came to live in a farm on what is now known as Tucker Hill. And he worked there on the farm for a number of years. And then he met my grandmother during the period of time, and they were married. And I'm not sure exactly how the arrangements were, but somehow they'd saved enough money so they bought this farm. And how my Uncle Fred came over, I think about 4 or 5 years after that, as I recall. And the story goes that my grandfather bought the farm, and Uncle Fred came to one of the neighbors just over the hill, as we always used to speak about it, probably a mile apart. And it said that they really didn't know that one another was so close. And there was a party fence that divided the different parties, and they had a mutual agreement that they'd fix the fence together. And they, then the family story goes that they, the farmer who lived on the side that my Uncle Fred lived on, was at, asked him to go to this certain place to meet whoever came from the other side. And it happened to be, according to what we understand, that the two brothers met at this place that we call the gate, where they begin to fix the fence. And that was the first time that they knew that each other was so close to each other.
I think that's just an incredible story.
It is.
One of the things that you told me, the isolation in the wintertime, how glad you were to see the mailman and the, you know, that.
Yes. And as I say, we lived a life that was pretty much local. In addition to the fruits and vegetables and things that we were not an unusual family. Most of the families did this, provided for the winter and so forth. They bought flour by the 100 pounds and sugar by the 100 pounds, and there was no need to go to the stores many times, and lots of times it was be more than a week before they'd come down off the hill and go to the stores. And cut here now. I've lost my trend of what you asked me about.
At one point you told me about...
Oh, I know.
You know, coming, the mailman coming and the mm-hmm. storekeeper. I mean, these were the people that mm-hmm. had news and...
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. As you know, the postal service in those days was done by horse and buggy, horse and sleigh. And we knew about what time that the mailman arrived, and we had about maybe a half a mile to walk to the mailbox. And we'd always get the news of Barry Daily Times. At that time was the paper that was mostly looked at here. And of course the news spread, but the other means of communication was by the telephone lines. Well, the telephone lines were much different than they are today. The first ones that I recall came over the hill from the Faiston side to the Warren side, and it was our responsibility. Each patron had to maintain the telephone line from their property to the next property. Well, we had quite a distance there, this half mile or so, that we had to maintain. There's always some brush coming down on it or shorting it out or something like that, and we'd have to trip. Well, as youngsters, we thought it was a great thrill to go over that line, and if we found something that was the matter, well, we solved the problem. Another thing, very anywhere, 6 or 8 up to the teens of patrons on the same line, and each had a number. Well, each number that was rung on the line happens. You could hear him for some what to the story lived in this. Not because when he came back, we went by. We're still just about burning. There was a lady along. So they just been there. Well, so.
The Clarence Strong story, ending it by saying, you know, that after he set that up and then ended.
Yes. When someone saved my, and they hung up, and Mr. Strong had the use of the phone.
The chain and the up about and the farms.
Brought up on the hill farm, what we term a hill farm, it would be impossible to farm in the fall. Milking was done by hand, At that time, when I was very small, no one shipped milk. Each town, Warren, Waitsville, Moortown, all had what they call creameries. And the milk was separated, run through a separated, and the cream separator, and the cream was taken once or twice a week to the creameries, where they churned it into butter. And then there's usually a mill, and Warren had a mill, that made butter tubs. And they packed that butter into these tubs, and it was shipped off by rail. And the rail out of Warren usually was in Roxbury, went over Roxbury Mountain, while Waitsfield went to Middlesex, and that was shipped out of there. It wasn't until quite a few years after that that the demand for fluid milk came into existence, and that meant quite a change. Well, they still milked by hand, some of them, but some of them had what they called Delco milk, Delco plants that generated current for milking machines. And that brought on quite a demand for milk, and then it was put in cans. They had to cool it early in the morning and then bring it to the stations, and it was shipped out. That was shipped out on milk trains that they call to Boston and the greater metropolitan areas. And each time that that happened, the creameries went out of existence. And a lot of those creameries were bought and owned by the farmers that shipped the milk there, and they had stock in it. A lot of them over the state lost all their money because they failed up. Well, then, of course, as we come, as the years went by, the cans were mostly shipped, cans of milk were shipped out. But then came the bulk tanks. And when the bulk tanks came along, that hit some of the smaller producers real hard because of the investment and so forth. And a number of farms went out then. And that's when the farms began to grow larger. Instead of a dozen to 15 cows, it went to 30. And then now we have, I guess the average must be 60 or 70. And the means of transportation and supplying to these greater areas is taken care of through trucks rather than the rail. So we've seen quite a revolution in the dairy industry, especially that was Vermont held on to its position in the production of dairy products rated high for many, many years. Still does as far as the total production. But it's a revolution that took place over those periods of years. And getting back to our school days and life on the farm there as a youngster, and going to school, as I mentioned earlier, was a different way of life than we see today. As I say, my brother and I walked for a number of years. It was 2.5 miles back and forth. When our younger brothers and sisters, sometimes my folks took them with a wagon or sleigh and then took them down and then brought them back at night. And school was out at 4 o'clock. During the winter, it was out at 3:30. But we started out when it was just getting daylight, 7:30 to go, and then by the time you come back, it was pretty much the same. One of the things that I remember, especially in the home, that when we were youngsters growing up, that the family would all gather around, and my mother would read different stories, Robinson Crusoe, Alaska stories, the Eskimos, other parts of the world and so forth that were of interest to us. But walking back and forth, especially after the snow had gone, but we had lots of fun in the wintertime skiing. We skied differently than we do now. The skis were made locally. We skied in the open fields, and we made jumps. But the skis were not, you didn't have bindings or anything. They were just a strap that you chuck your toes in, sometimes you lost your skis and they'd take off through the field and you'd have to go get them, chase them. But the thing that I guess I'll always remember is certain trees, a birch tree or a maple tree or some of the different varieties, and how they stood as we walked back and forth from school, not only on back and forth on the road, but we spent a lot of times in, just roaming around the farm and the hills, and you got to know those certain trees in certain areas. We knew where the hepaticas grew, where mayflowers grew, where the different violets, the blue, the yellow, the white violets, the adirondacks, because they don't grow everywhere. There are places where they're more susceptible to growth than others. And we also knew from over the hills and places where certain animals lived, whether people believe it or not, but like a fox, for instance, you will find a fox in a certain area, and it's just a natural for them. That's where they'll be. And then when they take off and run, they'll have certain areas that they run. Well, it's the same way about a lot of different animals. So that there's a lot of nature out there that I feel that maybe the young people today don't have an opportunity to take advantage of what nature affords them.
Do you want to take a break?
Yeah, I guess so.
No,
I guess I'm set. Okay.
Should we try the long trail?
Yes. I mentioned the fact that we did a lot of walking and through the fields, through the woods, as part of our just enjoyment that we had as young people, youngsters we actually were. And that's why I guess we learned to love and appreciate nature such as it is. One of the things that we sort of look forward to and did a number of times was hiking on the long trail. My brother and some of our friends went several times. And one time I recall my mother and father and my brother and a couple of good friends of my folks, the Newells, who he was a commissioner of education in Massachusetts and had a summer camp here in the area, and both of them were quite in age, but yet they just loved it. They were real happy, nice people, and my folks enjoyed them. And we all went and hiked through the long trail from Glen Ellen through to Camel Hump. And it was over a period of time, and I remember how it rained and so forth. And we got soaked, and then we had to dry out at the camps that night. And one of the last times that I was probably 12, 14 years old, their son and my brother and I, and we're on the long trail, and we camped out at the foot of Camel's Hump. And that night, with flashlights, we hiked up to the top of the crest to where you could see both east and west, where you could see north too. But one of the things that I remember, there were it was a time that there weren't all that many cars, not anywhere near like it is today, and you could sit up there, and there was not a sound that could be heard anywhere, except if there's such a thing as a sound of silence, that's all that there was. But you looked in the distance one way, and you could see these little round lights. They were really small, as you can imagine, at a distance like that, on going down Route 7 or going back Route 7, and the same way on Route 2 from Burlington to Waterbury. It was a setting that will always stay with me as far as that goes.
That's good, yeah.
I know, I had the other one, but I can't. The next one I was going to go on to, but I forgot what it was.
Oh, no, don't. We can...
Oh, I know what it was.
What?
The changes that I've seen through life, I often think about them coming from the home that I was brought up in and school, and how things in our immediate area meant so much to us. As we look back at it, at that time I didn't think about it when we were young, and see the changes that have taken place, the means of communication, the changes that have taken place. I mentioned the electricity, from where we had to keep what milk we had, we kept it hooked in the water tubs. Water tubs is what we call them, because most of the homes had a spring where the water ran into the kitchen usually, and the water tub is where a supply of water was. No electricity at the time. And I see what electricity has done over those years to now just about everything that we have, we depend on electricity. I don't think people appreciate the value of the electric current that we have to do what we have today. And I think of all the changes that have taken place as far as education and transportation and what's happened. It's happened so slowly, it's sort of a creeping sort of a situation, and life was slower at least that's the way it seemed to me back in those times. Whereas today it's a rush and rush and rush, and they say that that the rush hour is when the vehicles are almost a standstill on their way out of the cities. Coming up through the years, and a lot of my life's been involved around agriculture. When I was a small, before I ever reached 14, I was involved in 4-H and the dairy industry and so forth. And a lot of my life has been in agriculture and the values of agriculture, and see the changes that have taken place. And of course, after we came back here in 1948 and bought our first farm, we had about 30 cows at the time of it, and we had the cows, plus we raised 6 or 7 acres of potatoes, and then we had the sugaring operation, and each one of them proved out to be successful to us, for us. And things changed a lot since then. We had to, in order to meet the costs of operation and to make accessible operation, we had to make those changes by getting larger. When we finally sold the farm, we were milking average to milk around 80 some animals at that time, with around the barn stainless steel milking. And all stainless steel cooling and so forth. We, out of those 6 or 7 acres, my wife's folks lived close to us, in fact, where we are living now, and their son lived close by too. And after about 4 years, we bought my wife's brother's farm, added it to our farm, and then later bought the farm here, so we had 3 farms that were contiguous, just to make the operation a successful operation. We went further into the potato business and developed a route, and most of it in central Vermont here, to where we package potatoes. When we first started out, I had a pickup, and I had about I think I had 900 pounds of potatoes in 100-pound bags, and I sold them to some of the local merchants in Waterbury and locally here. And from that, we went on to, that grew into demand because we had a product, if I do say so, that was hard to, not to recognize the quality of the product that we had. And we could have raised a lot more because we had a truck on the road, so we delivered in Montpelier and Waterbury, and had a fine operation, really successful. But and we also had the maple, and we sold a lot of maple products, syrup, through those same avenues, and we built up a business that we still maintain in maple. As far as the potato was concerned, potato business. When the ski area began to develop, we employed in the picking time and some grading and so forth, packaging, we employed some local help, especially the ladies in the fall and the picking, when we were digging and picking. And when the ski area moved in, some of them got permanent employment there. Ours was seasonal, and they went to work there, so it was sort of difficult to get the labor that we needed. And many times it ended up so that the family, even with our children who were in school, we were having to work evenings to finish getting the load of potatoes ready to be shipped out, taken, delivered to the stores. So it sort of discouraged us there, so we built 136 feet onto our dairy barn and put on a few more cows and carried on that operation until we sold in 89.
So in other words, you got out of the potato business, or?
Yes. Because of the inability, I guess, in many instances to have a supply of labor, we just felt that our time would be better spent if we concentrated more on dairy industry, and we gave up a real good operation, potato business. Because of these factors, one of the main factors anyway was the availability of labor to do the job that was necessary to be done.
What are the major changes that you see, good and bad, that the ski industry brought in?
Mm-hmm. The ski industry, the year that we came back here in 1948, was the first year, I believe, that Mad River Glen was in operation. And it was a disaster that year, the snow. There was just not enough snow, and it was really bad. And some of the ones who had come here with only a few had to find employment somewhere else because it was such a bad year. Since then, it's changed, and people coming have bought up tracts of land, new homes, they built new homes, and a lot of real estate has changed hands. And we've always felt that it. It's certainly helped the economy overall. Employment, like we spoke about, why it shifted from our needs to needs on the ski slopes and so forth. And it brought about and has grown. Then came on Sugar Bush itself. It's changed the new restaurants. Have come into operation. This permanent help at the ski areas during the summer, Certainly, as far as the economy overall, it's improved. It's changed. I don't know how you can evaluate it, but to economically and dollars and cents, it certainly helped out. Even though at times they've had some bad seasons, price of property has changed immensely. People with financial means have come here, and if they've recognized the beauty of what we have in the community, they love the atmosphere that prevailed. The sad part about the thing, as many of us see it, is that though many people who came here for a reason, not only the natural beauty, but the people and the life in which they would like to live themselves, but after they've arrived here and after a certain amount of time, they haven't been able to forget what they came from, and we're being changed. Slowly but surely, I guess you would say that. You see a different philosophy among the people altogether. They talk about the natives and the flatlanders, and they're certainly not saying that they aren't good people. They're good people, but what they really came here for, what they wanted to maintain, is being destroyed.
Example of the school that you gave, the different attitudes. I think you told me that in school meetings, the natives wanted to do the work themselves, and the people that came in tended to want to hire somebody, and mm-hmm. It was always that different kind of attitude.
Oh, yeah. That's right, too. I told you about maintaining the roads, if you recall. seeing some of the things that have changed immensely, like I would say, living on the old farm that we were on and living in the town, it wasn't any different there than it is as it was in other towns in the rural areas. The roads certainly weren't of the structure that they are today anywhere near as we're having horse and buggies and horse and sleighs and so forth. The roads were such that the people themselves would maintain them. This is a hard thing to believe, but they would draw gravel, they would turn ditches, and they'd call them from culverts. They'd sometimes if the rain washed it out, they'd draw gravel with the horses on sled and bring it in, and sometimes the town would hire them to even pay for their taxes. So the roads were such that they were maintained to a major degree by the people who lived on those roads. And of course, that's changed immensely. And people knew that not in order to survive, but they just took it as a matter of course that they had an obligation to provide some of these services that today, they wouldn't be heard of. The people just expect someone else to do it, and it was the same thing in our schools, in our little rural school.
Maybe we should go back and get the part about the road.
again about how.
I wondered if I was getting it right.
No, you're fine.
Right.
It was the oven.
She was putting something in the oven, and it was clanking around.
Oh.
Yeah, it's amazing. These microphones are so sensitive. With those earphones.
Okay. All right, we'll go back then. The roads.
Shall we wait till Mrs. Iris sits down?
Yeah.
we'll give you a break anyway. You want a break?
Sure.
Here we go. Let's push on.
Okay.
The roads. Okay. The structure of the roads, it required back in the time of the horse and buggy, certainly were less than what's required now with the vehicle traffic and trucks and cars and so forth. And a lot of the roads were maintained by the people who lived within on those roads. They'd draw gravel, they'd where that needed it, they'd turn the water into the ditches. And they didn't wait for the town. The town didn't have all that much money to spend on them. And in many instances, the roads from out of Grand Hollow, where we lived, were sometimes they'd get together, the different neighbors, and just work to maintain those roads. And same way in the wintertime. There wasn't any great need for... a lot of maintenance, and the sleighs that went back and forth in the wagon and the sleds. Sometimes there wasn't any road there at all. They just knew where it was and they went. Later on, they rolled them, and we went on top of the snow rather than have it plowed out. So they didn't. That's the. Town afterwards, as time went on, they appropriated money and assumed the responsibility. But the people back at that time knew, as far as life was concerned, that they had a responsibility, a personal responsibility, to do some of these things.
When the ski areas came in, there weren't places for people to stay.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And that whole story about how people took skiers into their homes, and then the tax bureau came down. But
oh, yeah.
That I'd like to get that.
You'd like to get that one? Okay. The year that we came back in 1948, and as I referred to, what a disaster the first year of the opening of Mad River Glen, that changed somewhat. In the next few years, the skiers found out about Mad River Glen, and I guess a little later on, Sugarbush. And... they flocked in here, not at the number that do now, but certainly a lot more than they anticipated. And the facilities to offer them housing and provide restaurants and so forth didn't meet the demand. And in order to help out the situation, some of the households, some of the homes registered or didn't register. They said to the Chamber of Commerce, we'll help you out. And my wife was one of the ones that did, and they used to come here, and sometimes they'd come without any reservations. And they would stay in the various homes, and we for several years, this is what we did until more facilities were available. But one of the strange things that that I guess changed my wife's mind was that some 1 year toward the end of the year, as I recall, we had a visit by a couple of gentlemen from the tax department who said that they understood that she was taking skiers, and in order to have it, she had to register and she had to pay this tax. And that sort of changed things quite a lot. And even they'd come to talk with us, and then they even found out, because she had her capacity, all that she could take care of, we'd asked one of the neighbors if they would take a couple for one night or two nights. I've forgotten exactly what it was. And somehow they found out that they'd gone there to stay overnight, and they even went to see her and told her the same thing. And I guess the thing that really irked us the most was the fact that for a measly few dollars and so forth, the tax department has sent not one, but two people out to check up and to register and take and require the funds for whatever it may be. Sort of irritating to us to think that it needed two instead of just one, but that's government.
Well said. let me look at my notes here and see what else. One thing I forgot to ask you was the role of music in your family.
At home, there was, well, even in school, I guess, we always were, somehow or other, we always enjoyed music, and had an Aunt Dora that was a nurse who came on vacations and different times off to home. And she was always bringing new songs, new music, and we liked it, and so it was always the time for learning a new song. And it was the same way, I guess, all the way down through the years. And as we went to high school, and naturally, I like to sing. And we developed some friendships. And one of them that I've had a lot of pleasure singing with is with somebody I think you're going to hear about a little later on, is Bob Gove. And he and I are about the same age, and all during these years at different occasions we've sung together, and still are. We used to sing on the streets and in Waitsfield during high school, just in the corner, just to have fun and so forth, and the old barber shops, we spent some time there singing. And it's just been an enjoyable part of, I guess, our life. Yeah, this sort of therapy, I guess, for anyone who enjoys things like that.
Well, I must say, I think, the talent here is quite incredible.
So you did hear the...
Yeah.
Yeah. Well... It's been a lot of enjoyment. Yeah, so the answer.
There are two things I'd like you to say a little bit more, if you would, about. One of them is rolling the roads. I've never seen them roll the roads. Would you explain how that works?
Mm-hmm. Rolling the roads was probably a cylinder type, a wooden cylinder, probably some of them varied in size, but I would say the cylinder was about 6 feet in diameter, made of wood, and that turned as a horse drawn. It was horse drawn, and that turned and packed the snow down, so that the sleigh and the horses could walk on top of it. And that was packed down, usually with a four-horse team that they had. It was quite a big, heavy piece of equipment.
I always heard they rolled the roads first with the people that had the best hard cider. Is that true? That's what Sterling was telling me.
Well, I don't think there's any question about the fact that in those times, not everybody, but quite a number of people had put in a barrel or two of cider, and they knew how to process it and so on and so forth. And there's no doubt but what those who rolled the roads, there's no question. In fact, I've seen it to where they were offered a drink of hard cider in appreciation for rolling the roads, because it was difficult going through those snow at that time. So I guess that was the fringe benefit.
Sterling had some great stories about that. In fact, he told me that they used to heat up the hot cider with pepper.
Yeah, pepper?
Yeah.
Ginger, I've heard of that, but maybe he'd do something a little stronger.
Well, he told me about somebody that had home brew that he claimed he didn't know what was in that. One of the things, the way you put it before, was the new people coming in with a new philosophy, and you told me that they spent money faster, they were not as conservative, and they thought they had to hire somebody to do something. And I just wondered if you sort of rephrase all that.
Yes. One of the changes that I've witnessed and have been concerned to me, generally speaking, in the older years, the whole society was more conservative. And as I say, a lot of things were done by individuals, which now are done by voluntarily, which are now done by elective officers and so forth. And one of the things that I've noticed that a number of the people that have come from different areas, I hardly believe that they've had very much experience in town government or municipal government. And they sort of feel that, or they're inclined to believe that most anything that sounds good that they want, that they should have, and they don't realize that taxes have to be raised to take care of those costs and so forth. It's very noticeable that they don't take in. They think somebody else is going to pay for it, and they'll vote for things without taking into consideration somebody has got to pay the bill. And that seems to be one of the big changes that I see in the whole philosophy of the area. In our town meeting down here, there's hardly a thing that's proposed in the last few years but what they voted for, and yet when they get around to be assessed their taxes and they wonder why the taxes are so high, they don't take into consideration that it's all well and good. We can't have everything for everybody. And I think maybe that's why we find nationwide that there's more of a change now, more of a concern for being more conservative. Whichever party, there seems to be one wants to do more than the other now, which was changed the liberal element, I think.
The other day we also talked a little bit about how you got involved, and very naturally so, from farming to local politics to Department of Agriculture. And I wondered if you just sort of